You're listening to TIP.
The demand for chips is skyrocketing. So I'll throw some figures out here. $470 billion was the global purchase of chips, the chips themselves, back in 2018. And fast forward today in 2022, global chip sales were just shy of $600 billion. So it's a huge market, just the chips themselves, almost $600 billion, and it's on its way to $1 trillion a year. Some estimates point to it being maybe $1.3 trillion every single year by 2030. So if you're looking for a growth industry for the next 7-8 years, that's a compound annual growth rate of 7 to 10%, depending on if you want to use the $1 trillion or the $1.3 trillion estimate. It's a huge market.
On today's episode, I chat with Nick Rizzillo. Nick is the founder of Conkinus Financial. He's an investment portfolio manager and host of the Chip Stock Investor Show on YouTube. I brought on Nick to chat all about the semiconductor industry and to learn more about the best companies in this space, as today our economy can be described as a chip economy, where microchips have been applied to many technological advancements in different industries. And so Nick gives us an overview of the chip market, which industries are expected to drive the most growth and demand for chips in the future. He explains what the different types of chips are and which companies produce which types of chips, and he walks us through a number of chip companies like NVIDIA, AMD, Qualcomm, Taiwan Semiconductor, as well as Texas Instruments, and shares his thoughts on which companies he believes are undervalued at today's prices, and so much more. So without further delay, I really hope you enjoyed today's episode.
You're listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network, where your hosts, Robert Leonard and Rebecca Hotsko, interview successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation.
Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Hotsko, and on today's episode, I'm joined by Nick Rizzillo. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Hey, Rebecca. Thanks for having me on. Excited to do this.
Thank you so much for coming on today. I've been really interested in learning more about the semiconductor industry. And as I was doing my research of who I should bring on, your name kept coming up. You have such a great YouTube channel, Chip Stock Investor, which I've already learned a ton from. And so I'm really interested to know, how long have you been investing in chip stocks and how did you get interested in this?
Almost right from the get-go, I started buying chip stocks. When I started buying individual stocks like 17 years ago, 05, 06, a chip stock got added to my portfolio right off the bat. So at that time, I bought a company called ON Semiconductor, which I think we might talk a little bit about later. That was my first pick. I had no idea what I was doing. In hindsight, I should have bought like NVIDIA or Texas Instruments and just sat on it. But I bought ON Semi, which at the time was very commoditized manufacturer of power management chips. But yeah, I've been buying chip stocks for a while. I've always been interested in electronics. And so when I started investing, I got interested in semiconductors.
Yeah. So I want to dive into a ton of the stocks that you're interested in today. But first, I think it'd be super helpful to just go through an overview of the industry as a whole, because today our economy can kind of be described as a chip economy because microchips have been applied to so many technological advancements and different industries. So can you walk us through a brief overview of the semiconductor industry? How big of a market is it today and which sectors use the most chips?
Yeah, it's massive. And I think we're at a really interesting inflection point in the economy right now. So obviously semiconductors are not new. They were invented like 70 years ago, but we're reaching this point in time where I think they're coming out of the office. You know, historically you have maybe like an army of office workers using computers, and maybe they have some computing network shoved in a closet somewhere. But we're reaching this interesting point where both the power of the chip, or I should say the computational power of the chip, is increasing to a point and intersecting with the affordability of that computing power, where it now makes sense for all sectors of the economy to start using semiconductors. It makes sense. It makes sense for every sector every industry, and again, not just office workers using computers, using PCs, actually embedding those chips into daily operations. So it could be an energy or a utility company. It could be a medical company that wants to connect its medical equipment to a network. Obviously, electric vehicles and the, I guess, smartphoneification of the car, of the cockpit of the car. So all of these different things kind of happening all at once, and the demand for chips is skyrocketing. So I'll throw some figures out here, some pre-pandemic figures. $470 billion was the global purchase of chips, the chips themselves, back in 2018. And I start with 2018 because 2019 was actually a down year, if you remember the U.S.-China trade war. And fast forward today in 2022, global chip sales were just shy of $600 billion. So it's a huge, huge market. That's, again, just the chips themselves, excluding a lot of the software, a lot of the equipment, the raw materials, excluding all of that. Just the chips themselves, almost $600 billion, and it's on its way to $1 trillion a year. Some estimates point to it being maybe $1.3 trillion every single year by 2030. So if you're looking for a growth industry for the next 7-8 years, that's a compound annual growth rate of 7 to 10%, depending on if you want to use the $1 trillion or the $1.3 trillion estimate. It's a huge market. So that's a broad overview. Let's see, you asked about end markets as well, didn't you?
Yeah, for sure. You can get into that.
Yeah, you had this chart here that was a really nice visual showing smartphones actually are currently the largest market for semiconductors currently. Smartphones passed up the PC last decade as the largest consumer of chips. So again, remember, office workers, historically the users of computers, but then everybody became a user of a computer every single day, sometimes every minute of every single day, depending on how addicted we are to our smartphone. But in the next decade, I think there's a growing anticipation that data centers will become the largest consumer of semiconductors. So data centers being the main computing unit of the cloud. And there's some different things we might get into later as to why that is. But those are the biggest end markets currently: smartphone, PC, data centers, and servers.
I want to dig into the growth in, or the expected growth in, sectors in a second. I first want to ask you about the different types of chips, because I think that'll help us grasp kind of this overview of the industry. What are the main types of chips?
Basically, there's two broad types of chips, analog and digital. So an analog chip, you can almost think of it as just basically a sensor. Maybe if you want to compare it to like how our bodies work, our five senses, an analog chip is kind of like that. It might be a type of chip that reads a radio wave. So that would be like a mobile device, or it could be a power chip that somehow interacts with or alters the flow of electricity through a computing system. It could be LiDAR or radar or a vision chip. On a lot of new cars are getting these to help enable some advanced driver systems. Or maybe it's an industrial robot that uses one of these analog chips. So again, just think of like a sensor, and kind of like our five senses help us interact with the world, the physical world around us. That's an analog chip for a computing system. And then the second broad type of chip is a digital chip. And so a digital chip works with ones and zeros. So you could compare these to like the brain, our brain. And so within digital chip, you also have two basic types. You have logic and memory. So memory, it stores information for later use, and then logic, it crunches the numbers. It's figuring stuff out. And so the language that these things use are ones and zeros, or bits. And those are completely meaningless, but you have countless ones and zeros lined up together, and that's kind of like the most basic alphabet for software code. So that's a digital chip, and oftentimes these are like the most recognizable names, these digital chips. So like your Intel, primarily a digital chip designer and manufacturer. NVIDIA, AMD, both design digital chips. Micron is the top designer and manufacturer of memory chips in North America. So some very name brand type of companies fall within this digital chip segment of the industry.
And then which of those two chips is the market growth expected to grow the most? Like which has applications to, I guess, which industry?
That's an interesting question. So over the last decade, it has most definitely been the logic chips. especially the digital logic chips, more so than memory. And memory is kind of a different topic I think we'll touch on later. But so NVIDIA, now the world's largest semiconductor company, as measured by market cap, massive growth over the last decade from logic. The world has this insatiable demand for these logic chips. And I think the ChatGPT viral piece of software here the last few months kind of, I think, illustrates. It's not necessarily a new thing, but for the first time, I think a lot of consumers got introduced to AI. Behind software like ChatGPT is a computing system designed by NVIDIA, or at least the heart of the system is designed by NVIDIA. So massive growth for those. But again, we're at an interesting inflection point in the economy now where for the next decade, analog chips, which have for a couple decades now been kind of a sleepy, kind of a commoditized part of the semiconductor industry, are all of a sudden also expected to grow at a very, very fast pace. And again, a lot of that is being driven by electric vehicles, new automobile technology. And kind of parallel to that, a lot of similar technology used in the modern car also getting applied to industrial robotics. So manufacturing, food production, healthcare, and so on.
Okay, that was very helpful because I found that when you first dive into researching chip companies, there is so much to learn about how they work and which chip applies to what industry, which company makes what chip. And so I'm glad that you kind of broke that down for us today. And I want to dive into the expected growth of those different kind of sub industries a bit more because, yeah, I found that chart super helpful to just see the projected growth. And so data centers is expected to actually grow the most by 2030 and beat even smartphone demand, which I thought was super cool. And then automotive is expected to grow a ton as well. And then personal computing a little bit. And what was the other one there?
Automotive, yeah, consumer electronics, decent growth over the next decade. I mean, a market doubling in size over the next 8 years is pretty impressive, but kind of one of the sleepier parts of the market. So yeah, PC, consumer electronics and internet service infrastructure, kind of the slowest moving parts of this industry.
Right. So then that data centers one, you kind of touched on that. That is driven then by AI demand, essentially?
It's become twofold. So over the last decade, it's been just general purpose cloud computing, or oftentimes you'll hear it referred to as HPC, high performance computing. So these massive data centers that operate huge applications. So like Meta, the parent for Facebook and Instagram, operates massive data centers. I think this is actually a little known fact, but Meta is not just a social media app. They actually do some really deep, impressive engineering behind the scenes because they own their own data centers. And to operate something that can support 3 billion plus users around the world, at people using it constantly, every second of every day, somewhere on the globe, you have to have some massive infrastructure. So over the last decade, it was just the general purpose cloud. But now all of a sudden, it's AI, which oftentimes is just getting embedded into the cloud somewhere. So yeah, that data center market, I think it's going to actually surpass. Some estimates still think the smartphone market will be the largest consumer of chips by the end of this decade. I really firmly believe that data centers and servers, maybe like we could break that down further into public cloud like Amazon AWS or Microsoft Azure, and then also companies building their own private cloud network as well, their own data center based network for personal use. Those two things combined, I think, will outpace smartphones in the next, by the end of this decade. Some estimates actually pointing that memory chip demand will actually get sold into data centers more frequently than they do smartphones as early as next year, as early as 2024. And then logic chips, digital logic chips will catch up and in total surpass smartphones.
Wow. And so, okay, so the main chips for data centers are memory and logic, you just said?
Correct. Yes. So data centers are primarily logic chip driven. So you have all this information flooding into these remote locations, you know, that maybe there's one somewhere in central BC, central Washington, central Oregon, in the Northwest. You have all this massive information flooding into these things from the internet, or maybe from a company's private network. So again, it's like the central nervous system. If you want to compare a computing system to the human body, there is so much information flooding these things, and that massive amount of data is only getting larger as more devices get connected, more people get connected to these complex software systems and AI algorithms and whatnot. A massive amount of demand now coming from things like AI, and that's all going to happen in a data center somewhere.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, about a year and a half ago, my wife and I got married, and one of the most stressful parts of our relationship has been trying to join our finances together. We all know that money issues are a leading cause of divorce, but Monarch, the top-rated personal finance app, has built-in collaboration features so that you can invite your partner at no extra cost. Together, you can see all your finances, collaborate on your budget, and get insights on your cash flow and recurring transactions. It's the easiest way to manage your household finances. Unlike other personal finance apps that we tried, Monarch's simple, intuitive design makes it so easy to set up, customize, and use. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product, and they release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. Most importantly, they never sell your data to third parties or show you ads. After trying out Monarch for myself, my wife and I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners on this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/MI. That's MONARCHMONEY.com/MI for your extended 30-day free trial. Go to monarchmoney.com/MI for an extended 30-day free trial. Hey guys, have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only does the research and analysis for you, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Well, wonder no more. Meet Meka, your AI-powered stock research assistant, now enhanced with real-time stock data. Let Meka do the heavy lifting for you to significantly reduce your research time. And the best part, Meka is 100% free. Ask Meka questions like, explore the financial health of Apple through a summary of its balance sheet. Compare the financial statements of Apple and Tesla. What is the analyst price target for Microsoft? What is the social sentiment analysis of Amazon? And millions of other queries right at your fingertips. Visit Meka.com. That's MEYKA.com. Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
Okay, so now I want to get into your top picks. And we talked about this before the episode. It might be helpful to break it down kind of by sub industries. So let's start with cloud AI. Who do you think has the, or which companies do you think offer the best long-term prospects in this sub industry?
One of them I've already mentioned, NVIDIA, which in recent years I think has become a lot of people's favorite semiconductor stock. Hopefully because the business is awesome and not just because the stock price has rocketed higher. But I think that is the top pick and the market has really caught on to it. So even though by revenue, actual sales, NVIDIA is not the world's largest semiconductor company. It is, however, the largest semiconductor company by market cap. And again, it's just being driven by this expectation that the data center and how much information needs to be crunched by these data centers is going to soar over the next 5 to 10 years. And NVIDIA has built itself as not just a platform company. It's another big tech company. Like we can think of Google or Amazon as a platform business that other businesses build themselves on top of. NVIDIA is kind of that type of company now. It's that important in the global economy. So as AI takes off, NVIDIA has the market cornered. If you're looking to build an AI system, you almost, keyword, I think, almost can't design an AI system without NVIDIA being somewhere in the mix at some point. So I think that's the top pick, expensive stock, ridiculously expensive stock. And it's just because of this expectation that they're going to gobble up the most of this market in the next 5 to 10 years. So I have a trio of them, though, that make up my top pick here in data center and AI. AMD, again, household name in years past, kind of the underdog to Intel, but they've really passed up Intel technologically in recent years. And then a third one that almost no one has heard of, Marvell Technology Group. So this company makes a type of processor called a DPU, a data processing unit, and they made a string of acquisitions the last 4 or 5 years to bolster their portfolio of different chip designs and IP that they can license out. And so they're actually a key company when a company is trying to design high performance computing for the data center. Marvell is a key ingredient in that work now as well.
Okay, I want to jump back to NVIDIA for a second because I'm wondering, you said they kind of have the market cornered. Why is that? What is their competitive advantage that no other chip company can do, or maybe are they trying to do and have failed?
Actually, so we're recording this a day after NVIDIA's last earnings report. And on the earnings call yesterday, an analyst asked CEO Jensen Huang that question precisely. And he pointed out, you know, they do, in fact, have competition. They've always had competition. NVIDIA's secret ingredient is the GPU, the graphics processing unit, which historically is for high-end video game graphics on a PC or laptop. They've figured out, though, years ago that the technology that their chips utilize can also be used as a computing accelerator. So a CPU, which in times past was dominated, a type of chip dominated by Intel, has its limits as far as what it can handle when it comes to these really, really complex pieces of software where there's massive amounts of data. The CPU can only process much of that data so fast. But the way the GPU is designed is it can kind of chop up this massive amount of data into smaller pieces and then process it in multiple threads all at once. And so it's being used as a computing accelerator. You still need a CPU in a data center, but like, let's say if you want to run an application like, let's say, ChatGPT, and it's been trained on this incredibly huge set of information on the internet, let's say, general information found on the internet, you can't just use CPUs. You have to use a GPU. And NVIDIA has been working on these things now for decades, and they're way, way far ahead. Both AMD has GPUs, and they're also far ahead Intel technologically on these GPUs.
Okay. And so what happened to Intel? Because I think I heard on one of your YouTube videos that they just kind of became complacent. But could you explain what happened with them and why aren't they farther ahead?
I promise I won't rant about Intel like I have on my YouTube channel. Intel's problems really go back. I think we can go back a couple of decades if we really want to trace Intel's problems today to their root source. So back in the early 2000s, a small company called Apple was working on this quaint little device called an iPhone, and they approached Intel and asked for help in designing a chip for it. And Intel took a pass. They said, you know, basically that's a neat little device, but that's not what we do. And so Intel completely missed the boat on mobile computing technology, logic chips, digital logic chips. They completely missed the smartphone market. And so they really kind of pigeonholed themselves basically in CPUs, which is one of the original types of logic chips. And they got pigeonholed in PCs and laptops and some data center CPUs. But again, as we just talked about, as these data centers get more complex and the software that needs to be run by them gets more complex, NVIDIA is actually ahead as all of these data center operators say, hey, we need new equipment to run an AI algorithm. They're not going to Intel for this stuff. They're going to NVIDIA. So NVIDIA kind of helped create this market as well. So Intel has missed multiple shifts in computing technology. There's some other issues going on as well, where I think they could have turned things around earlier, but they were just lazy. They got complacent. And after the handwriting was on the wall that, you know, the industry had shifted towards mobile and then later on cloud, they weren't quick enough to get up to speed with the times.
Okay, that is very interesting. I guess it just speaks to management, and I guess why good management is so important as always. I want to jump back to NVIDIA now for a second because, okay, their competitive advantage, you mentioned they are just far ahead in the GPU technology. And so there are a couple competitors though catching up. How strong is that moat, would you say?
For NVIDIA, I think at this point, it's pretty strong. An interesting thing about NVIDIA is it's not just a semiconductor company anymore. They're also a software company, but maybe not the type of software that we might think of. I think we've all gotten hooked on software as a service, SaaS, over the last decade. AI requires, and high performance computing and AI require oftentimes a highly customized piece of software. It might be dedicated specifically to a business or maybe a specific segment within a business. There is no one size fits all. And so NVIDIA has done a fantastic job over the last couple of decades now developing this software that makes its chips, its GPUs usable for the user, for the individual or the company that's buying them. So they have this very wide portfolio of software now. Oftentimes that software is bundled together and given away for free with the GPU itself. But increasingly, the last few years, they have been branching off into more advanced software that they can actually charge for. So again, in the last earnings call just yesterday, they actually gave the most solid quantitative number to date on their software business. And they said it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's super nonspecific. I don't know if that means 200 million or if it's closer to $1 billion in software revenue, but it's becoming a very significant part of their company. And when you combine two things together like that, very well-entrenched hardware that's very far ahead of its peers technologically with a software business that makes it very easy for customers to implement that hardware and put it to use as quickly as possible in their day-to-day operations, you now all of a sudden have a company that is going to be very difficult to uproot from the very fabric of the economy. So I think NVIDIA has a very, very strong moat at this point. And that's reflected, obviously, in the sky-high valuation. 1 year forward earnings expectations of well over 40. That's a very, very high price, even for a semiconductor company growing as fast as they are.
What is your view on the current valuation then today? Because I think anyone listening, and if they do their own research, could see that growth story and those prospects. But at the end of the day, if you pay too high of a price, then that eats away your return. And so what do you think of the current price and valuation?
I'm sure you have a diverse base of listeners. So if someone's looking for a quick trade to profit off of, NVIDIA is probably not what you're looking for. But if you expect to be a business owner, you want to own NVIDIA stock like it's your business for the long term, I think a dollar cost averaging plan still makes sense even at this point. There's definitely going to be some volatility this year because of that high valuation, a lot of growth already baked into the price. But if you're looking 5, 10 years down the road and even beyond that, this company has a ton of potential.
Now I want to move on to mobility, because this is a sector that a lot of our listeners probably know well. So who are the top leaders in this space and who do you think has the best chance for outperformance?
So old sleepy Qualcomm, I think, is the obvious place to start here, right? This is almost as close as we'll get to a monopoly in the technology industry. So Qualcomm has deep roots. The business was founded on mobile technology. In fact, it has this segment. They report their financials in two basic segments, and one of them is called QTL, Qualcomm Technology Licensing. It generates these days upwards of $1.5 billion in revenue every single quarter and generates earnings before tax over 70%. And this is just patents that they license out to companies that want to use Qualcomm's mobile technology, which there's not a lot of other places or alternatives that you can go. And so Qualcomm has this great baseline business that's incredibly profitable, incredibly stable. And so I think this is a good place to start. Then they have this other segment, QCT, Qualcomm CDMA technology. That's basically the chips. They design chips, and then when that chip gets sold primarily into an Android phone, they make some money off of that sale. So smartphones, tablets, even some PCs, Qualcomm doing a lot of work to get more of a presence in the PC and laptop segment. There's a really good chance, be it an Android or currently, anyways, for the time being, an Apple iPhone, you're going to have a Qualcomm chip, some Qualcomm circuitry in there.
Interesting, because I thought that was Apple specifically was one of the largest customers for TSM.
Yes, this is where I think maybe, so we recently put together a semiconductor industry flowchart, and maybe I should mention that, and we can share that here, because this is a complicated web of different companies and different suppliers. So Apple designs its own chips using a company called Arm Holding. Currently, Arm is a subsidiary of SoftBank over in Japan. SoftBank bought it back in 2016. So Apple purchases the patent, or licenses, I should say, the patent from Arm to design its processors for its iPhones, its iPads, and now also the MacBook. So if you have a MacBook or a MacBook Pro with an M1 or now an M2 chip in it, that's powered by Arm. And it's a different business model. So Apple basically buys the license and the rights to a chip patent. They customize it to their needs. And then once they're done designing it, they send it over to TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, to actually have the chip made.
Yeah, that was super helpful, because I do want to ask you about Taiwan Semiconductor, where it kind of falls on your list and your thinking. It got quite popular when Berkshire bought it, and I think among the value investing community, and then they later sold it. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on TSM.
Yeah, we should definitely start with Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway buying $4 billion worth of TSMC. And then a mere 3 months later, they sold 86% of the stake they had just purchased. It's a fantastic company. I will say that. It's a wonderful company. They actually port Intel. I think this just kind of illustrates how far behind they are. TSMC passed up Intel years ago as far as manufacturing technology capabilities. So Intel has lost its lead in designing chips. AMD has passed them up on multiple fronts in designing the chips. And then Taiwan Semiconductor has passed up Intel in manufacturing technology. And they manufacture a majority of the world's most advanced chips. So for smartphones and data centers primarily. So TSM is a wonderful business. I think Berkshire Hathaway ended up with $4 billion of this in its portfolio, not because of Warren Buffett, definitely not Charlie. I think it was Todd Combs and Ted Weschler that more than likely made this purchase in the third quarter, basically summer 2022. And then a colleague of mine, Billy Duberstein, pointed this out. He was listening to Charlie Munger on the Daily Journal annual meeting in mid-February, and Charlie Munger hinted at why they probably sold it. And Munger basically said he hates businesses like TSMC. His words, he hates them because to stay ahead of your competitors, you're constantly having to take your profits and reinvest them to develop new technology. So instead of getting most of the profits back as a shareholder, you're left with a fraction of the profits because most of the profits get reinvested to buy new equipment and develop new tech.
That will never change over time then, essentially.
Probably not. If we maybe say like the human brain is the gold standard of computing efficiency, you know, you eat food and our brains can do absolutely wonderful things on very minimal amounts of energy. Yes, computing technology will always have room for improvement. And then of course, there's this whole quantum computing thing that is probably still more than a decade away from being an actual commercially viable thing. So there's that too, that will change the game. And you have, yeah, this constant necessity to keep funneling money into capital expenditures. The machines needed to manufacture chips are tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of bucks a pop. And it's just a never-ending cycle. So TSM, absolutely wonderful business. But I think a lot of investors should really understand that level of capital intensity needed for the company to remain a wonderful business. It's not an easy industry to participate in.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what is happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what is happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I use each morning to kick off my day and stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days. I've noticed this at my own businesses that I've run. You'd be wise to find proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/MI. netsuite.com/MI. That's netsuite.com/MI.
All right, back to the show.
And so will their main growth then going forward be in smartphones then too for TSM, or are they branching out and will they gain market share in those other growing industries?
It will be a smartphone as well as a data center and AI based business. They will get growth from both of those industries. They have begun expanding on the facilities that they already broke ground on, I guess, in Arizona. They're building some new fabs in Arizona, and Tesla has apparently secured some supply from TSMC, but that's probably more than likely, again, the logic chip itself, not the analog chips. TSMC does not dabble in analog. They are a digital chip specialist. So kind of like the brains of the modern vehicle, that's probably an area they could get some growth from as well.
Okay, so they aren't directly competing with NVIDIA for that market share then?
Yeah, that's a good question. NVIDIA is a customer, as is AMD. Basically, anyone who is a digital chip designer is more than likely a TSMC customer. Intel wants to compete in this market. So currently TSMC and Samsung are the two biggest third-party foundries. So if you design a chip, you're basically going to one of those two, TSMC or Samsung. The problem with Samsung is they also manufacture chips for themselves. So you're kind of you kind of have a built-in competitor there. If you have a smartphone chip and you hand over your smartphone chip design to Samsung, who also just so happens to design and manufacture their own smartphone chips as well, you have a bit of a conflict of interest there. TSMC is unique because they are the only third-party foundry that does not compete with their customers. They only manufacture. So this is a market Intel wants to get into, but again, they will also have that issue where they design their own chips. So anyone who gives a design to Intel to manufacture for them, you have a built-in competitor there.
Right. So TSM seems like they have a pretty strong competitive moat, and it would take a lot to catch up with them, and many years, at least, even for someone as big as Intel, to even catch up to what they're already doing. So what are your thoughts on its current valuation right now, and I guess long-term prospects?
I think it is a decent value based off of what I can see. I think it's a decent value. There is an expected rebound. So currently we're in the midst of a slump, of a chip slump, and it is primarily logic chips, digital chips for PCs and smartphones. So that's a substantial part of TSMC's business. I think it's a decent value though, because there's an expectation that that market recovers starting the second half of 2023.
Right. Yeah, it seemed like a few companies communicated in their guidance that they think the first half of the year is going to be bad. And then they said second half will be rosy. I guess in terms of near-term risks to valuations, who do you see these short-term headwinds affecting the most?
The semiconductor industry is a funny place. It is a very far-sighted industry. If you believe the market tries to price in 3 to 6 months, let's say, maybe a year of information down the road in figuring out a fair price for a stock. Semiconductors are 6 to 12 months or longer. So actually, when the bear market started in 2022, semiconductor investors were already having to listen to outlook and an outlook for 2023 and this brewing slowdown in demand for PCs and smartphones a year or more in advance. So a lot of the current problems with the economy and the semiconductor space specifically are actually already baked into the share price. I think what we're now looking at is not so much what could go wrong, but what could slow down the recovery or delay the recovery of the chip industry. I think that's what we're really looking at this point. One area that is particularly susceptible is memory chips. So again, logic. Memory is very price elastic. The price on a memory chip, because it's a basic commodity in a computing system, the price on a basic memory chip will fluctuate wildly depending on how much supply is out there and how much demand is on the market. So with this current slump in PC and smartphone demand and companies trying to cut supply back, memory chip companies have been wiped out. So Micron has been hit very hard. But I think that's one area where if the market gets wind of a delay in the chip overall chip industry recovery, it's probably the memory market that is going to be the most sensitive to that. And it's going to pick up on anything going wrong the soonest.
That makes a lot of sense. I forgot to ask you about two more industries, and I want to get to that before we talk about more, I guess, the relative valuation of all these stocks. I want to make sure we have them all covered. First is the automotive industry, because you mentioned how that's supposed to be a growing industry with electric vehicles. So which companies are expected to gain the most traction in this industry?
The obvious pick here is Texas Instruments. Probably the stock that I should have bought first 17 years ago, not on semi. Texas Instruments is an absolute giant. About 3/4 of their business is analog chips. So they're ready to go for this coming boom in automotive technology, and to a lesser extent, industrial robotics. They're ready for it. They have a wide portfolio of sensors, power chips. If it's analog, you name it, Texas Instruments is probably there. They have a wonderful manufacturing base to work from. They have some of the lowest costs in the industry. Some of the lowest costs, I should say, maybe in manufacturing, period. not just manufacturing chips, but just manufacturing. They have done an absolutely incredible job of driving down their costs, and they have ridiculously high profit margins as a result. So I think TXN is a fantastic bet. On Semi, though, almost two decades later, I'm warming up to this one again. It was a commoditized business when I first bought it many years ago. But today, with the advent of electric vehicles, renewable energy, there's a new type of chip substrate called silicon carbide. So silicon, obviously the, you know, that's almost synonymous with the chip itself. You can call chips semiconductors, sometimes silicon. That's what they're made out of. Silicon carbide has carbon kind of blended into the mix, and it's able to handle much higher voltages and much higher heat, which makes it a great type of chip for EVs and renewable energy. And onsemi is pouring a lot of investment into SiC, silicon carbide. There's also a small, very, very tiny equipment, chip fab equipment company called Air Test Systems that I have a very small position in, but they provide equipment that is essentially quality control for silicon carbide chips. And this is a really interesting one, I think, that could get a lot of benefit from a growing automotive technology market.
I feel like Texas Instruments is one that is not super popular. I don't know, maybe that's just what I read, but it doesn't seem like it's as popular as TSM or NVIDIA and other ones like that, which benefit investors because typically then the price isn't as high. It's not run up.
You're absolutely right. It's a fantastic, I think, it's a fantastic value right now. It's one I have considered adding to my portfolio. Yeah, it's just not one of those like kind of sexy, high, super high growth logic chip names like NVIDIA or AMD. But I think that's a real shame because they're actually forecasting compound annual growth of 10% a year through 2030. There's nothing wrong with average revenue growth of 10% a year. Plus, Texas Instruments has this longstanding policy of returning 100% of their free cash flow to shareholders. So all of a sudden, you're looking at an investment that is probably going to compound at, you know, a mid-teens percentage on average for the better part of a decade. That's a pretty good long-term investment, if you ask me.
Yeah. And so we talked about so many different companies today, and you made such a great case for all of them in these different industries where they can capture more market share. And I guess I'm wondering, given that and kind of the near-term risks that could be ahead, which do you think are the best value right now and for a long-term investor, because we're not looking to sell it in 2 years or something, but which ones do you think are the best price right now for a value investor to scoop up?
Yeah, Texas Instruments is compelling. I think in addition to that, I do like Qualcomm. Obviously, the smartphone market is not a super high growth market like it was the last two decades, but there is still going to be some growth there. In addition to that, Qualcomm is actually taking everything it does in smartphones and now applying it to the automotive industry. So they're actually developing and getting some really good success selling their logic chips into automobiles. In addition to that, they do have a small software component as well attached to that auto business. I think Qualcomm is very cheap, and it's kind of been left for dead here as of late because of the decline in smartphone sales, but that's going to come back eventually. And along the way, they're getting some nice growth from automotive. I think AMD is still very compelling as well, even though it's this darling from the 2010s. They completely turned their business around and overtook Intel on so many different fronts. But I do still like this company. They are so far ahead in CPU technology, specifically for data centers. Intel still has like an installed base of like over 90%. For data centers, for the cloud. So as these companies need to update the equipment, because chips eventually, they either wear out and need replaced, or the technology has just advanced so much that a company is forced to rip it out and replace it with something new. As they rip out the old Intel hardware, I think there's a really, really compelling argument to be made that AMD continues to gobble up market share at Intel's expense in the next decade. So I think they're not participating as much in the accelerated computing part of the market like NVIDIA is, but the CPU space is going to grow, I think, substantially because of data centers and AI. And so I think AMD is also a compelling value for the next decade as well.
And then what about, are there any companies that you talked about today that you love them, but not at this price?
I love NVIDIA. I don't love the price. That's the most obvious one right now. But again, I think we're at this particular point where even if the price, if the valuation, I should say, not the price, not the stock price, if the valuation feels uncomfortable, it's really important to remember these semiconductor businesses, they have such far-sighted vision because it's expensive to manufacture chips. They are laying plans down for 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the road with their customers, with their partners. So you really have to like look at valuation 1 year or more out to effectively value what a fair price is to buy a chip stock today. So I would say overall, there's a lot of very attractively valued companies in the semiconductor market at the moment.
That was excellent. I think I'll end it there. I want to thank you so much for coming on today. I learned a ton from this conversation and I'm excited to watch more of your YouTube videos and keep up to date with this industry. But before I let you go, where can our audience go to learn more about you and everything that you do?
So the primary outlets these days for all of our research is the YouTube channel Chip Stock Investor.
Perfect. I will make sure to link that in the show notes for our listeners. Thank you so much, Nick.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the invite.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Make sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast app so that you never miss a new episode. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, I would really appreciate it if you left a rating or review. This really helps support us and is the best way to help new people discover the show. And if you haven't already, make sure to sign up for our free newsletter, We Study Markets, which goes out daily and will help you understand what's going on in the markets in just a few minutes. So with that all said, I will see you again next time.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to We Study Billionaires by the Investors Podcast Network. Every Wednesday, we teach you about Bitcoin, and every Saturday, we study billionaires and the financial markets. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.